I had Racing TV on in the background recently and got a bit of a shock listening to a race at Kilbeggan. Oh, hello, sorry, Cornelius here, Cornelius Lysett, presenter of the Cornelius Cast. Yeah, Kilbeggan, County Meath, Ireland. I've never been, but it looks great. I got this bit of a shock because the commentator said words to the effect that a runner called Railway Hurricane had unseated his rider, Connor McNamara, at the very first hurdle. He meant, I think, the up-and-coming jump jockey, Connor McNamara, whose brother Emmett won the Derby on Serpentine, and not the football commentator, voiceover artist, golf and rugby union commentator, and renowned expert on Irish whiskey. He must be, because he got 9 points on it as his chosen specialist subject on Celebrity Mastermind, that Connor McNamara. Well, we can find out, because Connor, the radio and TV person and my colleague at the BBC until I left at the end of April, is my guest on this latest edition of the Cornelius Cast. Ever been to Kilbeggan? Been there recently?
I don't think I've ever been to Kilbeggan, actually. There's not many parts of this island I haven't been to, but I've not been to Kilbeggan. It's great having a famous person with your same name. There was a television program in America called Nip Tuck, and there was a character in that called Connor McNamara. And often in America, if I check into a hotel, they go... Connor McNamara, you know, so hopefully people will think I'm the jockey now. I might get some upgrades.
Funny enough, at the last World Cup, what country did Cornelius play for?
Oh, yes. Was it Denmark?
I think it was. Two or three times during the World Cup, I was at home minding my own business. And before Radio 5 Live sacked me, I used to listen to it. And I used to get the fright of my life. And Cornelius running down the left-hand side.
Well, I mean, because when I was growing up, it didn't feel like there was an awful lot of Connors. And I think now it feels like there's more. And I wonder, do you find that where that Cornelius is? Do you ever meet a young Cornelius these days?
Somebody did actually contact me and say they were going to call their child Cornelius not long ago, but they changed their mind. Maybe I put them off. A friend of mine's sister was in the same class at primary school as you, by chance.
Yes.
I said through her brother, my intermediary, was he big into football in those days? And she said the principal of the school, it was called St. Nessen's National School, is that right?
Yes, correct.
The principal who sadly died not long ago, Raymond O'Hagan, would have remembered you, she said, for playing a lot of football and talking a lot. Some of it about football.
I've always talked a better game than I play, which is convenient.
Where on the field did you play?
Well, so Raymond O'Hagan was the principal of our school, but he was also at one stage the coach of the Limerick Gaelic football team. So that was like a real prestige thing that you'd see your principal on the telly, like he was a coach of a team and, you know, wow. So therefore, Gaelic games, as they were in all primary schools in Ireland, were the big thing. And there was even for years, if you owned a Man United or a Liverpool or a Leeds shirt, you weren't allowed to wear that playing Gaelic football. I think they've softened. I mean, it would still be frowned upon a little bit, but, you know, they wouldn't make you take it off. But back in my day, you wouldn't be allowed. So they were very protective of it. So our primary school didn't have a soccer team, football team. It had a Gaelic football team. It had a hurling team. That's where the priorities lay.
And talking of talking, so to speak, you went to Crescent College, a Jesuit school, where Terry Wogan was the most famous old boy.
Yeah. No, we've a fantastic alumnus or whatever the expression is. Terry Wogan went to the Crescent School, and he definitely would be the sort of most famous broadcaster to come through the ranks. But Richard Harris was also
the actor,
you know, and he was a huge Munster rugby fan all through his life. But as I say, it's not that we had loads of broadcasters or loads of actors, but the ones we had were really prominent ones. And then there was, you know, plenty famous sports people and stuff as well. And that continues to this day. But that was something very much that I was aware of as a kid growing up, because my dad worked in radio. And this idea that, yeah, you could be a guy from Limerick, you could go to Crescent, and you could end up working for someone like the BBC. Like, that was possible. That wasn't some pipe dream thing. And I think Terry Wogan sort of made that achievable and you know, made it a realistic aim for a kid growing up. You think, yeah, you know, you could become a broadcaster. That could be your job. It wouldn't just have to be your hobby.
And is rugby GAA, which is more important in Limerick, or are they both equally?
Well, oh, it's a really good question.
Both more important than soccer?
Yeah, a million times. I mean, you know, the right. And, you know, no disrespect to them, and they're doing their best, but the soccer team will get hundreds watching them. The rugby and the Gaelic games will get tens of thousands watching them. So it's a completely different spectrum. The football team in Limerick, with the greatest respect, is equivalent to a non-league team in the UK, Whereas, you know, Munster and all those compete in European level the way any of the big clubs in England or France would do. So, yeah, the money is definitely in those sports. The football, soccer struggles for funding in Ireland. There's been various people who've tried to inject cash into it over the years, but they've never got it to take off. Whereas, yeah, rugby has always been well-funded, well-supported and whatnot. But it is difficult. So Limerick won the hurling championship. And there's a racing connection because JP McManus put an awful lot of funding and support for the Limerick team, and he was a hero in the dressing room at the end of the game, and they won. But it had been the first time in 30 odd years that they'd managed to win the All-Ireland final, and that was a huge deal for people. And then obviously the Munster rugby team had a great heyday with the likes of Paul O'Connell playing for them, and they won European Cups and whatnot, and therefore the success of the Munster team came down a little bit just as the hurling team got really successful again. So they sort of have dovetailed each other, but there was super excitement in Limerick when the hurling team won. And JP, to be fair to him, because people said, oh, look, it's all well and good, now you've put money into the Limerick team. But then the following year, having seen Limerick won, he then gave grants to every other team. There's like 32 counties. He gave them all a grant of, you know, a sizable amount of money to help with their facilities or whatnot. So he's been very generous in supporting not just his favourite team, but actually the entire sport.
And his racing colours are the green and the gold. Are they are the... What are they? They are
no,
some...
yeah. So that's South Liberties. So now my people will fact check this and tell me I'm wrong. So this is just off my sort of memory knowledge. But how I understand it is that JP McManus became the president of this GA club called South Liberties, his local club. When he was very young, he was still sort of in his early 20s, and he was president of this club, and that would be a rare thing to be. But it just showed how into it he was and what a mover and shaker he was in those parts. So he became the president of the club, and that's, you know, where he would have got to meet people like Eamon Grimes, who was a famous Limerick hurler who would have been on the team that won it back in the 70s the previous time. And of course he had a famous horse called Grimes, and there was Joe Mack, which was named after Joe McKenna, and he's another, and they'd all be pals. They'd play golf to this day. That, you know, they're kind of old school mafia types in Limerick. Like they're so tight that they're such big friends. But his love of Gaelic games would have come from those times, and then he always would have been a supporter down through the years. For years the Limerick team's sponsorship logo was, I think it was Sporting Limerick, and you think, well, what does Sporting Limerick mean? And that was basically a fund that JP had started up to help the sporting facilities in Limerick. So like he was their sponsor effect, providing the support to the team. But there's great stories. I mean, when they did win that hurling, JP paid for them all to go off to the Caribbean on an all expenses paid trip, and you don't see any evidence of it, because apparently the rule was you could all come, you could bring your wives and partners, you won't put your hand in your pocket. The one rule is no one's allowed to take a photo. So you have this huge squad and the backroom staff, and they all went off to Sandy Lane and had a great time. And there's no evidence of the fun that was had there.
And you've ended up commentating principally on football, but might you have ever been principally on rugby union or principally on GAA?
Yeah, well, no, GA, no. I mean, I've never done it, and you need to know your stuff. You can't just swan in and blag that, you know. And I'm trying to give an example now, and politely as I can, without slating myself. I suppose things like when I did boxing commentary at the Olympics. Now, I wouldn't have been a mad boxing fan all through my childhood, and I wouldn't have been ingrained in it. But I knew, you know, I wanted to commentate something at the Olympics, and I said to the BBC, look, this was years out. I said, look, I'd like to do a sport, and they said, no, but there's an availability now in boxing. And then what I did was I went off and I did some junior competitions and I did the Commonwealth Games, and it was probably like a 4-year cycle to get ready to do it. I mean, and you know, you could do that in a 4-year period. You could go to a few events, you could get up to speed, you could meet Nicola Adams, you could have the day training with her, you could feel you knew all about it. And then, you know, when it came to the 3-minute round, you were able to deliver a commentary. Whereas I don't think you could train yourself up for Gaelic games in that way. It's just such a cultural standpoint. There's expressions, there's phrases they use. There's insights on it. Maybe I'm giving it too much credit, but I would never even think of trying Gaelic football, even though I love watching it and hurling, and it's a fantastic, if people ever listen to it on the radio, it is brilliant. There was a famous Irish commentator, Micheál O'Meara Hurtig, whose voice is just iconic with Gaelic games, and it's a million miles an hour because the ball is flying around at superb speeds, and you're, you know, it's real breathing through your ears kind of commentary. You'd love to be good at it, but I just would never even try. But the other sport, I mean, I love rugby, like, and as a sort of illustrated for you there, rugby was such a important part of growing up in Limerick, and I was lucky enough to do, I still do some rugby commentary. I think football sort of takes over, as you well know, Cornelius. You know, if there's even a middle ranking football match on, it will take precedence over a more important rugby match or a more important race or whatever. It's given the higher profile. So in terms of a career and work There's just much more opportunities available in football. But I love doing rugby commentary, and I've been lucky enough. I was in Japan last year at the Rugby World Cup. I've done countless, you know, Six Nations over the last 15, 20 years. I've done Ireland games for terrestrial TV in Ireland at World Cups and stuff, which are, you know, big moments that the whole country is watching. So I've really, really enjoyed that. But those are sports I suppose that I just feel I'm more entwined with, whereas for Gaelic games, I'd be blagging it a bit and I think I'd be on somewhat uncertain territory and I'd be found out, most importantly.
Your dad is a well-known Irish radio presenter, Mickey Mack. A friend of mine from Limerick says, this is Mickey Mack on live 95 FM is his sort of, is that how he starts his program or something? That's a bit of a call sign.
Yeah,
for
well,
him.
He does. He's doing a thing. He's doing a thing on that 95 FM station in Limerick, and he sort of, you know, like his name is Michael McNamara. Down through the years, he always called himself Mickey Mack. He did a very clever thing, and you got to think. So when I was a teenager, like if you were going out to a nightclub or whatever when you're 16, 17, 18, the last person you would want there is one of your parents, okay? But my dad, who, you know, and I'm guessing the age, he would have been in his sort of mid to late 40s at that stage. He reinvented, so he was a music radio DJ, like the equivalent of being on Radio 2 in the UK. You know, he wanted to kind of reinvent himself as something slightly different. And it was around the time that Pete Tong started doing the dance music on Radio 1. So he said, I'd like to do that, but I won't be taken seriously because Michael McNamara was the guy playing, you know, Elton John in the afternoon. How can he suddenly be the cool Pete Tong type of guy? So he reinvented, he got rid of Michael McNamara and he became Mickey Mack, which was like the whole idea of him to be a different person. And all his publicity photos were in silhouette and he'd wear a baseball cap and you wouldn't really see his face. And, you know, he was, you know, probably trying to look younger than he was or whatever. But it was brilliant. So he played in places like the Ministry of Sound and Cream in Liverpool and all these places. And to be honest, talking about blagging it, I mean, to be honest, he was, you know, getting away with it at that level for a guy who, again, wouldn't have been mixing records since he was a very, no, he was always a DJ and he was always playing dance music. But in terms of that real technical mixing of the records, which were, you know, there was no talking in those nightclubs. It was just mixing one song into another. But he ended up having this program and having it ready. And then when I would go to nightclubs in Limerick, my dad would be the DJ, you know. So, but it's quite a feat to pull off for a teenager of that age to think your dad is cool and to accept that and to actually go to that nightclub and not have to feel, oh God, I need to become a goth and start listening to The Cure or something in a different nightclub.
I was going to say, did he really use as a sort of a bit of a catchphrase, shake your bib and bang your drums?
Yes, yeah, which I still never really understood what it was, but he used to say shake your bib and bang your drum. It was some sort of a let yourself go, you know, be free, enjoy your dance and stuff. He totally stole the whole Pete Tong welcome, welcome, welcome thing. And you got to appreciate, you know, back in these, this is the 90s in Ireland, people couldn't pick up, maybe a few people in Dublin might be close enough to pick it up, but you couldn't pick up Radio 1. So he would listen to the Pete Tong show, he would hear the newest tracks that were being played, and then he'd get them, and he would use a lot of the expressions that Pete Tong would use. And of course, people in Ireland thought, wow, this is great, how does this guy know this stuff? But it worked out really well, and he kept doing it well into his 50s, so he managed. And then he did the ultimate sort of recreation again, as he went back to being Michael McNamara, and he got a program on Lyric, which is like the sort of classic FM equivalent. So he was playing classical music, but back as being Michael McNamara. I think he's back being Mickey Mack again now. He'll never stop. As soon as one trend fades out, he'll reinvent himself as the other.
I just love that. Shake your bib and bang your drums. Yeah, I think larging it up, he used a lot as well, which...
Yes.
It's great, but it's not quite like shaking your bib and banging your drums, really. So in my sport, in racing, people talk about pedigrees. If you'd been a yearling going into the sales with broadcasting in mind, you'd have made a few quid, wouldn't you? Because the pedigree, you know, you were a son of something of a Galileo.
Yeah, well, he'd love to hear that. Yeah, no, I mean, I remember when Dad used to be broadcast, I would go into the studio with him and I would, you know, before he'd go on, I'd be playing on the mixing desk and I'd be like recording my voice and pretending I was the DJ. And that was definitely a thing that I would have done a lot when I was a kid, as well as pretending to be a commentator. My mum's photos at home, I would have two sticker albums open on the table. And, you know, the teams were sort of in formation in a football sticker album. And it'd be, say, Ireland against England. And I would commentate on a match. I would say the fullback passes it to the midfielder.
Did Ireland always win?
And Ireland always won. I mean, England barely scored goals in these games. There was a lot of humiliation for the English. But in these games, I mean, I was probably 10 at the time. But And it wasn't like, oh, I want to be a commentator. It was just the thing I was naturally doing. But yeah, so in our house, radio was the medium. That was what we spoke about around the kitchen table. We used to always, you know, we were driving in the car. If someone would do something that we thought was very slick or well, you know, we kind of look at each other, oh, he's done that really well. Or if something was tight, you know, that kind of idea on the radio that, you know, the two things segued into each other really well. So that was the sort of, a you know, total nerdy stuff. But that was the stuff we appreciated in our house. And that was all through Dad being on the radio. I think it's where he got his love for it was... His mum and dad, his mum was a very, you know, for her time, very forward-thinking person. She was one of the first women in Ireland to get a degree and a master's and all that kind of stuff. And she, you know, she was not going to be a sit-at-home mum. Like, she wanted to get out and do stuff. And she was a teacher. And in those days, when you had children, you were told, it was like the law, you had to stop being a teacher. You had to. And she was just not, I mean, she wasn't to be sitting at home minding kids. That, you know, she was an entrepreneurial type woman. So she set up her own school, a kind of a private school, and she set it up herself to be able to keep working. But part to do with that, they obviously need someone to help with the kids. And there was an elderly lady who they sort of took in, part caring for her and part that she would help with the kids. But she had worked for BBC Radio 4 back in the day previous to that, you know, probably back in the 1940s or whatever. So she had this well-spoken voice and whatnot, which then I think definitely influenced my dad about, you know, how to speak well, how to breathe, how to be able to make yourself understood. So that, I think that's where he originally got the bug for it. And then that sort of passed on through to me. And my brother's a singer. And again, it's all the same thing between microphones and projecting your voice and stuff. So I think it's carried on through the gene pool.
Voices, definitely voices.
Definitely, yeah.
And you worked for Today FM and TV3 in Ireland when you must have been ridiculously young. At the BBC since 2002. So what brought you away from Today FM and TV3 to the BBC? To BBC Sport.
Yeah, Today FM started up as the first independent, and they wanted to do a sports show at the weekend. And they wanted to do a thing that RTÉ wouldn't do, which was to cover English football, which, of course, is very popular. And I was in university in Manchester at the time, and I sent in, this is how old it is, a cassette of me pretending to do reports on a game. I remember pretending it was a game at Old Trafford, Manchester United. And I was inventing a game, and Man United win 2-1 or whatever it was. Dennis Irwin scored the winning goal. And I sent this tape in, but with very other, you know, just my name and address and whatever on it. But I didn't say how old I was. And they must have thought I was a little bit older. So they gave me a dream job at the time, given I was 18. They gave me a job going to Premier League games, be it at Old Trafford or at Anfield or at the old Highbury. Every Saturday and every Sunday, I went to matches. And it was like my university time work. But it was like doing a PhD in it, because I was getting to interview managers. I was in the stadium. It wasn't doing commentaries. I was doing reports. What an opportunity to get. And nobody else my age was getting that sort of opportunity. So, you know, started doing that. And then that station did get the rights for the FA Cup final at the end of the first year. So this was 1997. And I was 20, and they obviously tried to get someone else to do it, but they had only had one match to offer, so no one was going to leave a good job to you know, to take up for one game. So they rang me up. They said, I always remember the guy's word. He said, no, don't answer straight away, but do you want to commentate on the FA Cup final on Saturday? I'm like, of course I do. I'm not going to pause and think about that.
Chelsea Middlesbrough, I think.
And the best thing that ever happened to me was there was this goal after 40 seconds, fastest goal to that point in an FA Cup final. And that relaxed me and calmed me down, because up until then I was, you know, I had stuff written out, pre-prepared stuff that I was just going to read. Whereas that made me like, something's happened. I have to commentate on the game now. And I still do have the cassette. I mean, it's terrible. You listen back to my voice is so squeaky and high pitched and totally embarrassing. But what an opportunity! 20 years of age, you're commentating on an FA Cup final live at Wembley. And from that moment on, I could say, look, I'm not a student commentator. I'm not a wannabe commentator. I am a commentator. I've done a game, and that sort of propels you. That it was right place at the right time. That the TV station, what was then TV3, it's now Virgin Media, started up, and they wanted to get viewers to, you know, literally in those days, get down their hands and knees and tune in the new station. So they got the rights to Republic of Ireland games. And they said, well, who are we going to get? We can't get someone from RTÉ. Who else has done commentaries? Oh, well, there's a guy who does it for this independent radio station. Oh, yeah, get him. And again, they didn't realise he's only a kid. Oh, yeah, we'll get him. And then I was really lucky. So right place at the right time. And then from there, there was no looking back. Mark Lawrenson used to do the studio stuff for TV3 in those days. And he told me that BBC were starting up this new digital sports station, Sports Extra. And he said they'll be looking for new commentators. You should send a tape in. And I did. And then Cadge Sowell, who's a good mutual friend of ours, was sort of in charge of that back in the day. And he took a chance of me, this Irish fellow, you know, couldn't pronounce half the names of the towns in England. We'll give him a job on BBC Radio. And thankfully, there's been no looking back.
Ever think about doing some racing as well as football?
Well, you see, you don't remember this. And it's to be honest, it's a wonder we're still on talking terms. So I don't know the exact year, but roughly 15, 16 years ago, Rob Hasty was in charge of racing. And he said to me, yeah, okay, I like the way you've done that. He wasn't in charge. Cornelius was obviously in charge. He had a role. and he said to me, he said, you know, we need more than one commentator for the Grand National. We have different commentators around the course. And we've heard you doing the football, and we think it'd be good to have an Irish guy, you know, so why don't you do it? And he pretty much gave me the job. He said, you can have the job, you know, we're going to use you. So I was like, this is fantastic. This is maybe 4 months out.
I do remember this.
And then I, to my absolute stupidity, said, well, do you know what? It'd be great to do a little bit of a practice. Could I go to a race meeting and practice the comment? And they were like, yeah, sure, we'll organise it. And one day I went, and it was you, and I believe it was John Hunt was there as well. And he said to me, come along and you can commentate on the, let's say, the fourth and the fifth race. So I was like, perfect. So the night before, I learnt off all the names and colours. I literally drew out the colours of the jockeys. I knew them all. Yeah. And I was like, hold them up. Yeah, what horse is that? It's that. What horse is that?
Very
horse
old
that?
School.
Very old school, but I was going to impress on this because I knew you'd all be listening. I knew it'd be recorded. And I was going to show you all how good I was going to be. And I was thinking, for the rest of my life now, I mean, I'm never going to be a full-time racing commentator, but every year I'll do the Grand National. It'll be a great day out, you know? And of course, I showed up, and for whatever reason, you guys packed up early. You know, there was some other event that happened, and you were like, we're now not going to cover those races, so we're going home. And the guys came in and started dismantling the monitors for the replays and stuff. And they said, so instead of doing the fourth and fifth race, Connor, just do the third race. It'll be fine. Just do the third race, and we're going to leave. And I was like, I didn't know any of the jockeys, any of the horses, anything. And I couldn't even focus the binoculars properly, and all I could, and of course it's at Aintree, the massive course, so they were the riders were all running away from me, and I could just see these white arses of the jodhpurs up in the air, you know, as the horses are running away. How, you know, even if I knew the colours, I couldn't have identified them. So it was terrible. So that was it, swept under the carpet. McNamara's glorious horse racing career was never to happen.
Yeah. Well, you've written some great things about being a football commentator, masses of them. I love this story. As an Everton fan, I love the story of you with your back to everybody doing a report at Goodison Park, in which you were critical of David Moyes, and you finished, turned around, and David Moyes was standing listening to you.
Oh, yeah. And it's quite pertinent at the moment with the social distancing and whatnot, and you'll have noticed watching games now, they do all the interviews outside on the pitch, and I do hope they keep that going, actually, because it used to be in the tunnel, and football tunnels were not designed, you know, with television studio capabilities in mind. And particularly Goodison is the narrowest tunnel. You'll see the players come out of it. Really, really tight tunnel. You go down it, and then there's a 90 degree turn to the right. And it was in that sort of corner of the turn where we used to often do the radio interviews. But you could reach out both hands and you could touch both walls. So I'm there plugged into the wall doing a thing at a sports report, and I'm saying how terrible David Moyes' decisions were, and really, you know, what he doesn't know what he's doing, and blah blah blah. And then I turned around and David Moyes is like 1 foot away from me listening to all this, and you just want there's nothing you can say, you can't make it better, you just want the ground to open you up. But he just gave me a withering look and walked away, and I was just put in my place. The thing is, I don't know, do you find this great? And maybe it's less in racing, but it's something that only occurred to me recently is we spend a lot of our time being critical of people. You know, it's the reason they didn't win was because someone made the mistake, or someone let them down, or someone did the wrong tactics. That gets discussed at least as much, if not more, than, oh, well, someone else did something brilliant, that's why they won. It's more, well, the reason the first team didn't win. And I think of it now in regards, you know, my own kids, whatever you think, like, all these people's parents will be listening on the radio, and who's this person, you know, criticising my child? And, you know, it's made me more aware of it. And not that I'm not going to do it. I mean, we have to be critical. That's the nature of our job. But it kind of makes me realise, oh dear, you know, if people do it. And the reason it came to my mind was in one of these games behind closed doors where there's no crowd, doing a match at Aston Villa, and John Terry, who's the assistant, was down with Dean Smith, and they were only about 10 feet in front of us. And we've our headphones on and we're commentating away, and you're not really, because there's no crowd, they can hear everything you're saying. And at one stage, we're being critical of the Villa defence, and John Terry turned and looked up at me, and I'm like, oh no, this is just terrible. But it definitely makes you aware that you treat, because they're famous, because they get paid a lot of money, you think, oh, they're bulletproof. They can, you know, we're completely in our rights to just to criticise what they do. But you got to feel, you know, it is going to affect them at the end of the day.
Well, and funny enough, the other way around in terms of racing, I think people, you know, there are races from Cheltenham and Epsom to Sedgefield and Chelmsford. And sometimes you can be rather dismissive about a horse running in a lower tier.
Yeah.
But somebody owns that horse and somebody pays for that
horse.
That's
their big day out. Yeah.
Yeah. And they do get upset. One of the few times I fell out, well, it wasn't really a fallout because it lasted about 5 minutes. But it was a good horse called Kicking King that won the Cheltenham Gold Cup and the King George at Kempton. And he was beaten in a race at Haydock, and I'd been quite rude about his performance. And one of our producers rang the trainer, Tom Taff, to get him on the radio to preview whatever he was running in next. And he said, "I'm not talking to you again." And you know, your man was rude about the horse. But to be fair to him, he said, "Tell him to ring me up and apologise." And so I rang him up, and he was absolutely fine. But obviously, the pressure was definitely at the time just getting to him.
The worst I have, and I've never actually said this before, but the worst experience I ever had was I was doing a rugby game, and I'm going to give you a few background details because I don't want it to be traced to who it was. I was doing a rugby game, and I came to meet people in a pub afterwards, and they were all just good. Ireland had lost the match. It was an Ireland game. And they said, "Oh, you know, what do you think went wrong today?" And I just arrived in there. "Oh, this is Conor. Conor's been commentating on the match. What do you think went wrong today?" And I went, "Oh, well, player X." Now, I could have picked any player. I just, for whatever, I was put in the spot. People were listening. I went, "Oh, player X. I mean, terrible. Just, you know, he's like..." And straight away, my friend jumped in and said, "Conor, I'll stop you there. This is player X's mum and dad." And I tried to though. Oh, but by his high standards, he's not. And I was just like, this is just. I still to this day wake up in the middle of the night sometimes in a cold sweat over that. It was just this horrible moment where I was still in radio mode. Oh, I'm just broadcasting. You know, no one.
Yeah.
Is that real people listening to me, or I'm not speaking to an individual? And then suddenly it was like that. Yeah, that's their mum and dad. And I learned a lesson that day. Absolutely.
Tell me, changing the subject, tell me about Celebrity Mastermind, because I've watched a clip.
Why haven't YouTube, you done Celebrity Mastermind?
Well, clearly not a celebrity. That's well, and I definitely, when you finished, when John, so right, your name please, Conor McNamara, your charity, and you named a children's charity in Manchester, which was lovely. Your chosen specialist subject, Irish whiskey. Jeez, it's quite a wide one. But then I thought to myself, well, I've been on the odd night out with Conor McNamara and his good friend Kevin Kilbane and others. He might be quite an expert on Irish whiskey.
Well, no, what I felt was you can't, when you do this, you can't actually pick your specialist subject. And the reason being is if, and you can look up Murray Walker chose Formula One. People should YouTube that. It's quite a harrowing experience because the people picking the questions went, "Oh, this is Murray Walker. He knows everything about Formula One." So they asked incredibly difficult questions of which he hardly got any of them right. And that's mortifying. And, you know, if I had said Premier League football or something, and if I, you know, you're putting yourself on the spot, the people expect you to know this stuff. If you get it wrong, you know, you look a holy show. So deciding that, I wanted to do it. I was chuffed to be asked. And then I said, okay, well, you know, what's the worst thing could happen here? The worst thing is I would pick, you know, Republic of Ireland football teams, and they would ask me because I might get them wrong and I would look a fool because that's something I should know about. So I was like, well, how can I come out of this with any self-respect no matter what? And I said, I had this image in my head that I would be like Don Draper in Mad Men, that I would walk up, that I would sit down exactly as you described. What's your name? What's your charity? What's your subject? And for that split second when I went Irish whiskey, people went, "Oh, right, okay, he must have something about him," you know. I mean, regardless of what would happen from that point on, I felt that would be a cool moment. So that's what I went for. And then I did a bit of reading up on the Irish whiskey and whatever, and I didn't do too bad in the questions.
You were very good. You got 9. One of your passes was about Tyrconnell whiskey from the Watts Distillery. Yeah. And named after a race course called a race horse, I should say, called the Tyrconnell, which won what's now called the Vincent O'Brien National Stakes in 18 something or other.
Tyrconnell, but, yeah.
And it's actually got a little picture of racing horses on the label. What do you call it? Do you call it Tyrconnell?
You know, Tyrconnell. Yeah. Sorry. I mean, the question that I passed on was. About some temperance priest who was anti-whiskey. I was like, that's nothing to do with Irish whiskey. That's like a side issue. How dare
I'm
you
not
ask
the sort
that?
Of person you'd know at all.
But but when you do, I mean, I've never been so nervous. I mean,
that's what I was going to say. As you go and sit down at the end, you can watch as the colour comes back into your face.
No, I mean, and I'm not sort of dramatically inventing this. I was bricking it. I was so afraid. And an hour before, if you'd said to me, "You can get out of this, you know, I would have definitely got out of it." And I feel all the other contestants are the same, because you're setting yourself up for a fall here. You're going to be a holy show. It's pre-recorded. You will then have to sit for months until they play it at Christmas, and you know it's going to be terrible. You know, it's funny when you say about, you know, not a celebrity enough. One of the ladies who was on when I was on, she was one of the women who was on Loose Women, the TV show. And she came up, and she was the first up, and she said just her first name. So they said, "What's your name?" And she said, "First name." And I was thinking, oh, I'm sure you're supposed to say your second name as well. And then I'm wondering, oh, do I, you know, should I just say my first name or whatever? Then the second contestant went up and they said both names. I was like, fine. So when it came to my turn, I went up and I said both names. At the very end, the whole thing had been filmed and the floor manager comes out and says, well, we just want to do a few pickups, you know, a few cutaway shots or whatever. And also, we need the first contestant back up again because you only said your first name. You're supposed to say both. And John Humphrey said, he said, Celebrity Mastermind, where the celebrities are so famous, even they don't know who they are. You know, she didn't know her own name, you know. You're up there and you feel... They're scraping the barrel for the celebrities when they have to get the likes of me. But it was a fun thing to do. And it's the kind of fun thing to, even now, you know, show my kids the video of it, that kind of thing.
Oh, it's great.
Bit of fun. And it raises a bit of money for charity.
So when will you be back? It's middle of September, is it? You're back up and running again?
Yeah, in August, all the Champions League and Europa League stuff is back on. So I do that for Virgin Media in Ireland. So I do a lot of in-studio stuff for the presenting, which is nice, just to do slightly different. But then the international stuff is early September, the Nations League, and then the Premier League is set to start again on the 12th of September. So it never really stops. I think particularly because we had that enforced 3-month break, I think from now... for the next 12 months, it's just going to be a lot of live sport. But look, you know, it's feast or famine. I think the first few weeks when everything locked down, I was pleased to have a few weeks off. I was probably overworking before then, but then you really miss it. So I think none of us will complain about it being worked hard now because we sort of appreciate, you know, what we have in that regard. And it's great to have live sport back. And obviously we don't have the crowds in, which is a huge part of it.
Well, hopefully that'll happen soon. I want a tip from you. The Premier League, will they retain their title?
No, I'm going to play to my audience here. I'm going to say that Everton, under Carlo Ancelotti, are going to be the surprise team of next season and are going to be in the title race.
Please give us a proper tip. Hopefully they will be in the title race. But people are talking about a great team?
Yeah. Of course they're a great team. They've won the Champions League and then the Premier League back to back, and you know, and they've been in the Champions League final the year before. There's absolutely no flash in the pan. What's really intriguing for me about Liverpool is that Klopp put this team together, and their strength has been how he's kept that core group. But history tells us that you always have to keep refreshing, and it's the players they bring in now. They brought in that Minamino player in January, who's been sort of peripheral. It's how does he bring in the next Salah and the next Mane and the next Jordan Henderson, and how successful that will be the success to see. Does he turn a very successful period into an actual era, into a long-term plan? But Liverpool, the team to beat, everywhere they go now next season, people think if we beat them, we could beat anyone. I mean, that's the standard they've set. But it's, you know, Manchester City seems so dominant for a few years and Liverpool have come in and usurped them. So that it's the beauty of the football that we genuinely never know. They'll be the favourites, but it'll be a great achievement if they can continue to win for the next few years.
And just think, if that day you'd come to Aintree, everyone had stayed to do races 4 and 5, yeah, which you'd mugged up, and you weren't made to do race 3, you might not be preparing for the Premier League. You might be preparing for, you know, the Champions Day in October, the King George at Christmas, and beyond.
You would have been forced to start this podcast many years ago, Cornelius. You would have been turfed out. I would have absolutely loved it.
It's been great chatting. Thank you so much, Conor McNamara.
Thanks, Cornelius.
Thanks indeed, and best wishes to you, if not to Liverpool, for the upcoming Premier League season. Thank you to you for listening to this latest episode of the Cornelius Cast. If you've enjoyed it, please subscribe, and then you'll never miss an episode. And whether it's good news or bad news, feel free, please, to drop a little review if you get a chance. Anyway, we'll chat again soon. Lovely to talk today.